Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling, this tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her mouth.
From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, welcome to Yin Radio. Today's show is called Good Heavens. It includes all kinds of explorations of the heavens, astronomy, theology, extraterrestrials, and astrology. We have a piece from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It's called SETI, where scientists are systematically looking for ET. And the rulers of the heavens, gods and goddesses, are the subject of the second installment. It's a new myth of how gods came to be. Then I talked to an international astronomer, a woman who works at the giant radio observatory in Puerto Rico, Arecibo. And we end with the show with a piece from astrologer Maria Teresa Maggi. We're going to start with a musical lesson in astronomy and our place in the universe, though. And we're going to start with humor. Let's go to Monty Python.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. Keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
Installment number one, aliens. They're the major theme of science fiction and UFO hunters. They're also the focus of hard science. Using a huge array of radio telescopes, scientists are searching for ET by listening for the signals that they broadcast. Now, we humans create a cacophony of electromagnetic noise. Cell phones, radios, television, and satellite communications. From radio waves to visible light to X-rays, the way that we use and create these patterns in the signal are not natural. Any extraterrestrial who is listening would hear our electromagnetic patterns and know that they were made by design. They didn't just happen spontaneously. So it's easy to assume that any advanced creature would likewise use electromagnetic communication. At the SETI Institute, SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, astronomers are scanning the sky for ET's noise. I spoke with Edna DeVore of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California last April. Edna is the Deputy Chief Executive Officer and Director of Education and Public Outreach at SETI. And she's most interested in the question, are we alone in the universe? I'm speaking with Edna DeVore, the Deputy CEO and Director of Education and Public Outreach at the SETI Institute. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is what SETI means. Thanks for talking with me today, Edna.
Oh, you're welcome.
So you and your colleagues work on probably a number of questions, but the big one is that big question, are we alone in the universe? It's a question that intrigued Carl Sagan and, of course, you and many, many others now. And the topic, at least I first came to know it through science fiction books, but the more recent science fiction movies, you know, notably Jodie Foster in the film Contact and Spielberg's E.T., all these science fiction things going on and sparking our imagination, but now the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is real science. How did this shift happen?
Well, I think that what's happened with Hollywood's version of looking for life beyond the universe and not only Contact and E.T., but even, you know, the beginning of Independence Day was a SETI search, and there's been several other kinds of films, reflects what's been going on in science for some time. The first paper that proposed we used radio telescopes to tune into the rest of the universe was actually published in 1959, and the next year, very shortly after this paper was out, and actually separately from the paper, Frank Drake set up a small system at a telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, and tuned into a couple of stars looking for signals that might come from an alien technology on a planet circling those stars. He wasn't successful, but that was really the first SETI search. So looking forward, not very long from now, in 2010, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of people looking for ET using technology here on the ground. But the question of whether life in the universe exists beyond the Earth is really old. It goes back to people in the times of Greece, and it has been a question that's been, philosophically at least, played with by a lot of people over the ages since then.
Did it take technology a while to catch up so that we could begin a real search?
Well, if you think about it, when we observe the whole universe, we often think that the way we observe the universe is in visual wavelengths because that's what our eyes see. You know, we're the first observers. With no technology at all, we can look up and see stars and figure out that there's planets and a sun and moon and whatnot. And the concept that we could actually understand something remotely is a more modern idea, that we could look at the light that came from those places and figure something out about them. And that only goes back into the times of when science came along to be able to analyze light, or then subsequently when radio receivers were invented and radio was invented, which is basically within the last century. That's when we began to realize, well, maybe we could pick up the signals from someplace else, the radio transmissions from some other civilization. And so we really, at this point, we really look in sort of two parts of the spectrum. We look in the radio wavelengths that get down to the surface of the ground so we can observe them from the ground, and we look in optical wavelengths as well with some sort of clever technologies that are newer that look for pulses of light coming toward us. The other parts of the spectrum where there could be communication signals aren't visible from the surface of the ground because the atmosphere blocks them out. So most of the SETI searches have focused either in the radio and more recently in optical wavelengths. And it has to just do with the nature of our atmosphere. And so did the technology take us to a place where it could catch up with thinking about and looking for ET? Yeah, it was the invention of, first of all, radios that transmitted, and then the notion that, oh, well, maybe somebody else is transmitting because we can use the basic physics of the universe to communicate. Somebody else could figure that out, too. And then the development of listening devices that would allow us to pick up radio signals from other places. And that's all happened, within the last 100 years.
So in looking for ET, what we're basically doing is listening for their radio signals or some other signal.
Yeah, we're not looking for evidence of ET by, trying to pick out what tree is sitting underneath. We're looking for ET by looking for evidence of the technologies that they use. And one of the real basis of a lot of SETI searches now is that we think we understand that in the natural world, whatever kind of electromagnetic energy we pick up, whether it's visible light or x-rays or radio or other kinds of wavelengths, any kind of signals that we get tend to be very spread across a piece of the spectrum. They have a wide footprint, you might think. And technologically generated signals concentrate the energy in a very narrow band. And so they look distinctively different than things that come from natural emission. And that's one of the premises behind how do you come up with a SETI program to look for technology someplace else. You look for narrowband signals. And you look for signals that are drifting in frequency because they're on a planet that spins. And they would drift as they came toward us and away from us due to Doppler effects. So there's, that's one of the basic ideas behind how do you define a SETI search so that you could identify the technology emissions from some other place. I think that one of the really tricky things about looking for a SETI signal is that we expect them to be extraordinarily faint. And so there's some very thoughtful and heavy-duty computing that goes on to any of the signals that, any of the observations that are made in SETI searches to try to fish signals up out of the noise. We don't expect a huge spiking signal to just jump out at us. We actually expect to be looking for pretty faint things. And so there's some very clever kinds of computing that has been developed to help us try to sort through the noise and see if there's anything there.
So paint a picture of what is going on here. I mean, the images that many of us have are, again, Jodie Foster sitting out in an array of these giant dishes with headphones on. Sounds like she's not going to hear too much.
No, she's going to hear a lot of hiss and pop and snap and whatnot, and she's going to hear some higher level signals, but they're going to be man-made. I mean, the notion that you can get away from all the radio chatter on our planet is pretty naive. There's so many transmitters sending out so many signals. Everybody's cell phone is a transmitter. Everybody's car engine with its electronic ignition system, everybody's garage door opener and their microwave oven, and the list is more or less endless, are transmitters of one sort or another. So when we used to observe at Arecibo, you could sit and look at the screens and be looking at multiple wavelengths simultaneously, and you'd see all kinds of spikes showing up, but they were traceable directly to man-made objects, either in orbit around the Earth or on the ground nearby. And so the strategies that our SETI scientists use to sort all of that out include some fairly clever things that would distinguish between a signal that's coming to us from an object in motion in space versus an object that's screwed down to the ground nearby or even in an automobile nearby. And those kinds of things can all be sorted out. And so we get a lot of signals, but they're all man-made so far.
And what do you think would happen if we do find evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence? It's going to, first of all, be very exciting, but what happens immediately? And then the larger question is what happens to our worldview and our culture as we see ourselves in this different place in the universe, so to speak?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I think in the more immediate and sort of practical way, if our organization or one of the other groups that are doing SETI research get a signal that they think is real, what's the first thing they're going to do? They're going to call their buddies on the phone and say, would you tune over here on your radio dial with your big telescope? Because that part of the sky is going to set for us now, and we need to have you look and see what you find. And so there would immediately be this desire to confirm what we found. And that's just within the scientific community. I think the second thing that happened is that once people felt that it was a legitimate signal, is that it would go public. It's not anything that would be hidden from the community or hidden from the public. This is something that would need to be announced to the world. And what would the world's reaction be? Oh, I think almost anybody and everybody who thought they had something to say to ET would point their telescope or build a little radio telescope and start pumping information in that direction. I think that in the bigger picture of things, there'd be a lot of interest. If you go back to, it was a few years back, there was a Martian meteorite analyzed down at NASA Johnson Space Science Center. There was the announcement made that they thought they had found fossil life in this meteorite.
Yes, I recall.
Yeah, and there was a great deal of excitement about that. And in fact, in retrospect, I understand an analysis was done of science stories in the news media, in the newspaper media. And that one got the most column inches that year, by far. So there was a huge amount of public interest, but you don't hear a lot of people talking about it today. I think people would be enormously excited if we thought we had picked up a radio signal from a planet around another star. And they'd want to know all about it, and could we decode the signal, which is not real likely immediately. It might change the financing for SETI programs. There might be money made available to do more searches or to search that object more thoroughly. But the public will move on to something else when they find out that, gee, that star is, how many billion miles away, and that if we send a signal back and say, hi, we saw you, it might take several years for them to say, thank you very much, good to hear from you. And so I think there'd be this initial impulse that would be a high level of interest and really kind of exciting, and then the news would start to look for other kinds of things, the next Hollywood starlet who's in trouble with the law. So I think that would change. However, in the longer range picture of understanding that human beings on this planet are not the only species who can make communications technology in the universe, if it's a SETI type signal, that would, again, change our notion of our place in the universe. If you go back 400 years, people were arguing about whether the Earth was at the center of the universe or the Sun was at the center of the universe. And Nicholas Copernicus published a book on his deathbed, said, gee, it all works a lot better mechanically if you put the Sun at the middle and the Earth goes around the Sun. Johannes Kepler, at about the same time, figured out from data that was taken a set of laws that would explain how planets orbit the Sun, not why, but how they orbit them and at what speeds and how their orbits were related to their distances from the Sun. And so Kepler became one of the first people to go from a lot of data to the understanding of the natural world, not being able to say why the planets orbited, because he didn't come up with gravity. That was Newton's idea. But it was another piece of the information that was needed to say, gee, maybe the Earth is not at the center of the universe. Maybe the Sun is. And Galileo used a small telescope to say, gee, Jupiter has moons going around it, so something besides the Earth could be the center of gravity. And that was another piece of data in that whole argument. It was some time later before we were able, though, to demonstrate that the Earth was in motion. Because as much as you could argue that this was a really good idea, the data wasn't there to support that. And that happened much later on, after the invention of the telescope and other kinds of observations occurred. Ultimately, we came around to the notion of, okay, we live in the universe, which is one large collection of stars, and the Sun is probably at it, because if you look in all directions, they seem to be more or less the same density. And that idea held until the 20th century, that there was one universe out there, one big galaxy, and that the Sun was probably toward the center of that galaxy. But there was these disturbingly little fuzzy things all around the galaxy. And when larger telescopes got built and we looked out, we realized that they were other universes or other galaxies. And suddenly we weren't at the center of the universe. We were simply a member in one galaxy. And at about the same time, we figured out we weren't even in the middle of the galaxy. So humans' place in the universe has gradually changed over time. And I think that if we discovered E.T., and we eavesdropped on E.T. and found out that there was another technology developing civilization someplace, there'd again be that kind of step forward of, oh, you know, we're one group of intelligent creatures in the universe, and now we know about another one. And philosophically, that would start to change people's perception of their place, I think, in the universe.
Have you had any close calls, or how many do you have every, I should ask?
Have we had any close calls? You know, that's a really good question. I mean, there's been interesting stuff show up on the screens that the computers will highlight too, because there's so much data coming in, human beings would quickly fall asleep looking at little fuzzy lines on the screens. And so once in a while something will happen that really draws our attention. And so far, all of those incidents have been involved with satellites, either satellites that circle the Earth or satellites that circle the Sun. And a few years back, one of those, which is called SOHO, and SOHO is still up there, was transmitting toward the Earth. And when transmitters point at the Earth, there's also what's called side lobes, and it's kind of lower levels of radio transmission. And we happened to line up with one of those on a distant star, and it looked like a signal. It looked like we were getting a signal. And SOHO was in motion, and we were in motion, so we saw the Doppler shift that you might expect, etc. And there was quite a bit of excitement about it. And after about 8 or 9 hours, people figured out that it was indeed a satellite, and it wasn't that we had found ET on a planet around that star that we had selected to look at. But it took several hours of serious review and looking at all the satellite databases and thinking very hard about, okay, is this a real signal or is this not a real signal? And ultimately it wasn't. But it was a very fun fire drill.
Yeah, I would think that would be disappointing, but quite an emotional roller coaster.
I think so. I mean, a tremendous amount of excitement. I know that Jill Tarter, who's the director of our Center for SETI Research, keeps a bottle of champagne in her refrigerator here at the Institute at all times, ready to toast when we make that discovery. And when she's up at the observatory and on the telescope doing observations, there's a bottle of champagne in the refrigerator there too, because she anticipates success.
And what do you think? Do you think somebody's out there? We're going to find them?
I think that it's for me, it's a broader philosophical question, because the universe is an enormous place, and we live on a modest-sized planet around a fairly ordinary star. And I'd have an incredibly hard time believing that this is indeed the only place out of this vast universe where there's intelligent species of some kind that can observe and comprehend the natural world around them. I just would have a terrible time thinking that that was so. I mean, if you want to go back to Jodie Foster and the Contact film, it would be a terrible waste of space.
Well, I'm glad you're asking it, and I appreciate you taking some time with me today. Edna DeVore, the Deputy CEO of the SETI Institute. Thank you, Edna.
You're welcome, Sandy. Thanks for calling.
Is there anybody out there?
Today's Yin Radio theme is Good Heavens. We're going to move from extraterrestrials to gods and goddesses who rule the heaven. So in this next installment, it's all about them. It's all about the goddess and her struggles. Christy Schwartz reads a myth that, like most others, has a lesson to teach.
This reading is from Barbara Walker's book, Restoring the Goddess, Equal Rights for Modern Women. The chapter title is In the Beginning, the First of All Myths. In the beginning, in the time that was no time, nothing existed but the womb. In the womb was a limitless, dark cauldron of all things in potential, a chaotic blood soup of matter and energy, fluid as water, yet mud solid with salts of the earth, red hot as fire, yet restlessly churning and bubbling with all the winds. And the womb was the mother before she took form and gave form to existence. She was the deep, biblical Tehom, Babylonian Tiamat, Egyptian Temu, and Greek Themis. In the time that was no time, she divided the elements in her womb cauldron into the two spheres of infinity. By the use of her magic Om, her grunt of cosmic birth-giving, she caused the fiery lights and airs to collect in the heaven sphere, and the dark waters, salts, and solids to collect in the sphere of earth. She shaped the heavenly lights into sun, moon, planets, and the stars. She shaped the earthly materials into continents, rivers, mountains, and seas. By the light of the sun she made day, and by the shadow of the earth she made night. At the point of contact between the two spheres of infinity, her blood of the womb generated living things. To each living thing the mother gave a temporary form that would eventually dissolve back once more into the infinite churning cauldron of potential, where matters and energies are constantly exchanged and recombined. She made the world an image of that uterine cauldron, so that every life form sustains itself by absorbing, decomposing, and assimilating with other forms. And she gave autonomy to each form by pronouncing its name in her primordial language, expressing the verbal magic of creation. She made human beings able to imitate her in the use of language. She formed them of reddened earth, Adama, moistened in the womb by her own holy blood. She gave them consciousness capable of remembering their own passage through dark birthways into the light of seeing and knowing, capable too of envisioning their own return to darkness and disillusion. She made woman in her own image, with the female mammalian power to create new life out of her interior blood. She made man to be woman's consort and helper, to assist in the long, arduous nurture of the world's most helpless offspring. She taught her people to sow and reap, preserve food, weave cloth, build shelters, carry fire, make tools and vessels, keep record of the seasons, and a thousand other practical arts and crafts for their survival in the world. She taught her people not to take more than they needed from the earth, and the plants, the animals, the waters, and the woods, for if any creature took too much, others would suffer. The world and its creatures dwelt in peace until their mother began to give birth to jealous gods. Each god claimed to be her firstborn and her chosen lover, privy to her secrets, sharer of her creativity. Each god insisted that he alone was both her son and her bridegroom, as well as her helper in the world's creation. Some even went so far as to claim sole responsibility for creating the earth or its living things. It is written that the goddess's true firstborn took the form of the divine serpent to slide into her terrestrial body to be anointed by her wise blood, to know her inner wisdom, and to learn how to become immortal by periodically shedding his own skin and becoming reborn in a new, fresh one. The phallic serpent represented sexual knowing as man's way to contact the blissful life-giving magic inside woman. And so when men make images of the mother, they often show her accompanied by her snake, or even gave her a snake form. Later gods, jealous of the wise serpent, sought ways to discredit him. They pretended that the serpent's connection with the maternal netherworld was an evil rather than a special privilege. They began to claim credit for dividing the womb into earth and heaven, for the pronouncing of sacred names, and for the molding of clay figures to be brought to life. Some even claimed to be birth givers themselves, despite their male incapacity for that. One even went so far as to declare that he would make man into a birth giver. At least one man, the first, who could then usurp maternal authority over the woman who was his child. The jealous gods appealed to men, promising them longer lives, earthly riches, or godlike immortality if they would become dutiful worshippers. They taught men to perform blood sacrifices, to imitate the mysterious blood magic of the mother, to claim a connection with the giving of new life. Alas, the men never learned to let blood without pain or harm, as women did. Nonetheless, they mutilated their own bodies to imitate women's lunar bloodletting. They even killed some of their own number and claimed that the victims were transformed into life-givers by their outpouring of blood. The men promised to feed their ancestral gods on sacrificial blood to preserve their immortality, hoping for similar immortality in return. Their gods found blood sacrifices acceptable, but rejected the offerings of grain and fruit that has been customary in the elder times of peaceful agriculture. The new jealous gods were not kind to the people they claimed as children. They tyrannized the people and oppressed them mightily for the most trivial offenses. They threatened the people with plagues, wars, fevers, madness, blindness, slavery, famine, and rains of fire for the least infraction of their rules. One of the new gods even dared to send a world flood to drown nearly every creature on earth, even non-human ones, because a few of the people had displeased him. The mother caught him at it and became very angry. She punished him by setting a rainbow in the sky to bar him from feasting on men's altar offerings. She said he should starve, since rashly he caused the flood storm and handed over my children to destruction. Nevertheless, the jealous gods continued to attract men by a combination of promises, threats, and violence. The gods restricted men's expressions of love for women, even for mothers. They allowed men to seize their neighbors' lands and possessions, to enrich themselves, to make slaves of other people. They allowed men to declare themselves kings and to choose surrogate victims to be sacrificed in their stead. Men knew that many of the things they did were wrong, and their gods' threats made them guilty and fearful. They submerged their fear in acts of cruelty performed in groups so that other men could justify their behavior. They appointed male priests to condone everything and write that it was all the gods' will. Male priests wrested power from the tribal mothers and priestesses by organizing men into marauding armies, blessing their violence, and rewriting myths to exclude the goddess or declare her an abomination. The jealous gods became even more jealous and fought among themselves, and each pronounced himself the one god. Their warfare was unremitting, until one devoured nearly all the others, diabolized his few remaining rivals, and proclaimed himself superior, even to the goddess who had produced him and taught him all his ideas. And so the world was set upon a trail of tears, oppression, and intellectual error that prevails even to this day.
Christy Schwartz read Chapter 1 of Barbara Walker's book, Restoring the Goddess, Equal Rights for Modern Women, with the permission of the publisher, Prometheus Books.
Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath the soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our heart. Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath the soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our heart. Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath us, soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our heart. Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath us, soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our heart. Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath us, soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath us, soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our heart. Mother of darkness, mother of light, earth beneath us, soul in flight, songs of love and love of life, guide us to our heart. We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean. We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean. We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean. We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean. We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean. We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean.
We all come from the goddess, and to her we shall return like a drop of rain flowing to the ocean.
You're listening to Yin Radio. Our show today is called Good Heavens. We're going to go back to astronomy now with installment number 3, featuring Taposhi Ghosh. Stars are the same everywhere on Earth. Well, they're not really, I guess. The northern hemisphere stars are quite different from the southern, and at every latitude you're going to see things differently. But that hasn't stopped Taposhi Ghosh from studying stars all around the world. In this installment called International Astronomer, we're going to hear from Taposhi, who works near the equator at the Arecibo Radio Observatory in Puerto Rico. That's not where she started out, however.
My name is Taposhi Ghosh. I sort of halted a little bit because I'm from India, and my name is actually in India is pronounced as Taposhi Ghosh, but since it's spelled as T-A-P-A-S-I, everyone here calls me Taposhi. I can't blame them because that's how it's spelled in English, but the actual pronunciation is Taposhi Ghosh. That's my name. Mm-hmm. And I was born in Calcutta in India, and I studied there until I did my MSc, Masters in Physics, from Calcutta University. Then I did my PhD in physics, in astronomy and physics together in a city called Bangalore in India. And I worked with the radio astronomy group there. I was up in the mountains in the southern India in a very beautiful place. And so I was working there. I finished my PhD. Then I went to a postdoctoral fellowship to Holland. I spent 2 years there. And while I was still a student, Chris Salter, who was a scientist, astrophysicist from Great Britain, he was visiting my institute. So we met there. And then he went to a job to go to West Virginia, work for NRAO, and I headed off to Dwingelo, a little village in Holland, again to work with radio astronomy, radio telescope. But at that point, we decided we didn't want to live so far apart. We wanted to get married and find a place somewhere together. So we were looking for 2 radio astronomy jobs, which wasn't easy to come by. So for a year we looked, and then we turned up, you know, the Arecibo Observatory, which is actually an NSF-funded institute and a national facility. They were looking for astronomers there. So we both got two positions. My husband got the position to be the head of Radio Astronomy Group, and I was hired to be what is called friend of VLBI, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So we both got positions there. At the same time, they offered me a position at Chris's old institute at Green Bank in RU. So they didn't want to let Chris go. So they wanted me also to be there. Well, I think for that reason, because they didn't really know me at that time. But we decided to take a new challenge and go to Puerto Rico. So since then, this was in 1992, since then we've been there, and it's been an exciting time because when we went there, the telescope was going through a big upgrade. So we got to do a lot of hands-on work with the equipment and have our say in how this new telescope is going to be.
Well, let me ask you about your role now. You said that you are...
What's called, at that time, I'm still doing this sort of similar job, although I did many other things before. It's called Friend of VLBI. VLBI I'll expand that out, it's acronym for Very Long Baseline Interferometry. When my job particularly is that to basically starting from looking after the equipment, we need special equipment for that. When I started up, we bought new equipment. Some part of it was inbuilt within our observatory by our engineers. So I'm sort of in charge of putting it all together. And people put in proposal to observe. So when they come, when those proposals get approved by a peer review process, then I have to make sure that the observations happen. Very often, most of the time, I and other people also, and also my husband sometimes, together we run these observations because sometimes they are just like one after the other, so you need reprieve.
Well, let me ask you about being a radio telescope. Do you do run observations like 24 hours a day practically?
Yes, absolutely. So day, night, any time we may be called to do observation, whenever it's our time, or for my case, if anybody else is doing the VLBI run, I have to go and run it for them, make sure they get all the calibration data, they got good data, any pre-setting, pre-testing, all of that I do, and then send that data out to the users.
So do you ever get any rest?
Well, it's sure I do. No, that's one thing is I'm one of the lucky people who gets to do something that one enjoys for a living. You know, this is my hobby plus my job. So that keeps us going. If you can combine both, then that's really the best combination.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay. You're very welcome.
That was Tapasi Ghosh. I met up with her at the astronomical conventions and in meetings in early June in St. Louis.
Have I gone to the bed cloud number 9? Hey, you.
We come to the last installment of our Yin Radio show called Good Heavens, and we're going to go with comparative astrology. Maria Teresa Maggi is an astrologer who produces Star Garden Moonwatch for our very own home station, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. She knew that she was talking to an astronomer when she agreed to an interview with me, and while I have no real knowledge of astrology, I do know more about the stars and planets than average. So we had to start the conversation, of course, by comparing notes between astrology and astronomy, and comparing the disciplines. After all, the two are twins. Astrology and astronomy were born at the same time in history. Maria gives an abbreviated history.
We could say that astrology began as far back as the Neolithic age, when there's evidence of markings of the phases of the moon in cave paintings to determine either fertile times, hunting times. So in a sense, the moon is our first calendar. And our first experience as humans of cyclical time. By the time you get to the Sumerians and the Fertile Crescent and the quote-unquote beginning of Western civilization, Well, in every civilization, in every culture all over the world, there is something that has to do with the correspondence between the earth and the sky, what goes on in the heavens and what goes on earth. So what I'm saying is the science of astronomy and the art of astrology were one and the same thing. The difference between science and art was not apprehended in the way that it is now.
So to compare the two, astronomy is science and astrology is art. In the early days of history, they were Siamese twins, linked at the hip. The separation occurred much later, after the two disciplines had grown up a bit and had noted their difference. Okay, Maria explains again.
By the time you get to the Assyrians and the Fertile Crescent and close to about 1000 BC or so, rather than just looking at the cycles and the correspondence, this becomes like a way to predict things. If the cycles can be known, then perhaps, you know, we can say that if this is going to happen in the sky, then something like it might happen on Earth. Now, that's not exactly the same thing as an organic correspondence, but that then became part of it, you know. So then by the time you get to the Enlightenment and you get, you know, or right before the Enlightenment, you get Newton and you get Kepler and Copernicus, who were all astrologers as well as scientists. And they developed this different perspective of how to measure. And then popular, like the prediction taking hold, the measurement takes hold. And I think neither one of those things is actually at the heart of what astrology is.
So what is at the heart of astrology? I asked Maria.
For me, as a poet, this is another symbolic language. Its metaphor is literally the equivalence of one thing for another. It's not a causal model. It's a model of equivalence. One thing that's completely unlike something else is somehow equivalent to it.
And that leads us directly to another comparison that Maria touched on, and that's astrology and poetry. Both are examples of symbology, and both are understood as part of a larger continuum, Maria says. The past, the present, things going on here, things going on elsewhere, they're all connected. It may seem a bit New Agey, but wait. It makes sense if you compare it to poetry, even to an analytical mind.
What that means for astrology, or a poem, say, for instance, is the planets are out there revolving around, but our connection to them is also inside us. Or like in some way the place that you were born in the informs who you are, you know, and also your parents, your gene pool. Well, this just adds another dimension to it. The place on the earth you were born in relationship to the way everything else was moving around as the earth was moving around is also a part of you. Or for instance, if you take a little tiny poem by William Carlos Williams, this is another way of looking at it. This is called The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's the whole poem.
Let's hear that poem again.
The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Now, the poem is literally about, here's a picture of a wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater, so looking very red beside these white chickens. But it also means so much depends upon. What does that mean? When you come to that, you bring your experience, you bring what you know about what the wheelbarrow does, who the farmer is,
It rained.
It's both symbolic and literal. Poetry is both and I think astrology is both and. And perhaps on our path, our evolutionary path, we're trying to figure out both and. I mean, we didn't have enough of the measurement. We didn't have enough of the science, but then we went to the science and now that's all. Just because everything can be measured doesn't mean that's what it means.
What does it mean? Well, that is subjective. That's art. I asked Maria about just how that art is done. And that's a bit complicated too, but here's some insights.
Well, you're looking at a bunch of things. I mean, underneath it is the template of the zodiac and all the symbolic correspondences that go with that. Each sign has a planet that goes with it. So then you, on top of that is overlaid the person's chart. So that would mean, you know, the beginning of the tropical zodiac is the zero point of Aries. Well, depending on what time that person was born, well, maybe they have Libra rising. So that Libra, which is the opposite of Aries, is overlaid on the Aries. And oh, maybe they've got a planet next to that. So then that's another overlay. And maybe that planet is aspecting something else and something else. It's the geometric relationship between the planets in the zodiac on the birth chart. So, and all of those things mean something. You know, that is just one set of things that you're working with when you're looking at the chart. You're looking at all those geometric relationships. Then you're looking at the sign, those things occurring in the relationship of the sign and the planet and the relationship. So it's a lot of things. And then maybe if that pattern is being affected by another pattern that's ongoing right now. Mm-hmm. So those are all of the just like if you were looking at a poem, the images in the poem, how you read the images and how do you interpret that.
Yeah.
These are the things that I'm interpreting when I'm talking to someone.
It would take more time than we have to share all of it, but I'm getting a handle on it, and this is how I get it. There's a birth chart, and that's a map of the sky at the time that you were born. And then there's the current sky map. And since your birth chart informs who you are, just as where you were born and who your parents are informs who you are today, this birth chart can address some basic tendencies and traits. And in the sky today, there are new oppositions and planets have moved in their cycles. And these cycles reflect the cycles in our lives. So then comes to the interpretation and the art. From a lot of measurement, the basics, then we go to the search for meaning, and that is the art.
It operates on a continuum. So there's always a spectrum of possibility. Okay, here, you know, like here the moon is in this sign and Saturn's in this sign. Maybe they're in an aspect to each other that creates tension. Well, what does that mean based on all these other things? Here's the spectrum of possibility. Where do you want to focus your creative free will to work with this? If you want to ignore it, that's also a choice. But there always is this uncanny thing that happens where they'll say, why does this happen the way that you describe it? How did you know? Well, I don't know. I kind of see it as, well, I don't know. It's the intuitive part for me is like seeing patterns. The patterns are moving and the things are relating to each other and creating patterns. And somehow by being present with that process and just being in that moment, then you're kind of ride the pattern for a moment and you can describe it.
So we learn by comparing. Maria compared astrology to astronomy, to poetry, and to art. And I kind of get it. The why of it, I certainly get already. That why is because we're human and we need understanding and we need insights. We need options and someone to listen to us and to help us reflect on who we are and what our lives mean. How to run our lives. We need all the help we can get. But I'm often analytical and I need to get my feet planted on the ground. I can't get too out there. I asked Maria also about staying on the ground. She had told me that staying on the ground for her was actually found, to her surprise and to the surprise of many people, in astrology. Thus, another lesson emerges from comparative astrology. All things are relative. Or was that from Einstein?
The date, April 1st. The moon is on the cusp, ready to spill over and make a mess. Jupiter is in the sixth house on the left side of the street. You can't miss it. Uranus, whoa, I'm not going there, is in the third house. And Neptune is in a nicely furnished condominium, tastefully decorated in tweeds and teaks. Taurus is mooning Virgo, and Virgo likes it. With that in mind, let us hear from astrologer Dr. Adrian Horn Hummel from the Institute for Higher Things.
Today's birthday, April 1st. If you were born today, you really weren't born at all, because it was a joke. You don't exist. I'm sorry. Aries, tomorrow will come. Taurus, there is no tomorrow. Gemini, eat your vegetables. Cancer, don't eat Gemini's vegetables. He has to finish them himself, or he doesn't get to leave the table. Leo, you have been elected chairman of the Milk Fund. Collect $500. Virgo, go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Libra, I wouldn't do that if I were you. Scorpio, emphasis on the second syllable. Scorpio. Sagittarius, you're taking a long trip. Your luggage will get lost. Capricorn, you will find someone's luggage. Aquarius, look out. Behind you, there's a man with a big knife. Pisces, were you scared? Were you? Huh?
That was Dr. Adrian Horn Hummel from the Institute of Higher Things. And remember, as Shakespeare once said, our fate, dear Brutus, lies not in the stars, but in ourselves. What did Shakespeare know? He's such a big know-it-all.
Thanks for joining me for today's Yin Radio show. Good heavens. If you'd like to contact Yin Radio, please do so at yinradio at v as in voice, p as in power, found.org. That's yinradio at vpfound.org. I'd like to thank Edna DeVore, Prometheus Books and Barbara Walker, Christy Schwartz, Tapashi Ghosh, and Maria Teresa Maggi for today's show. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Until next week. The sky goes on.